because you're a woman, I'm not that interested, because by the time you're 30, you'll be having babies and making jam.
She wants to disrupt her own history. She wants to make it difficult for herself. She doesn't want things to go easily. She wants to grapple with them.
I desperately wanted to be a sculptor and to make sculpture.
Hello and welcome to Sculpting Lives, a podcast with me, Sarah Turner.
And me, Jo Baring.
In this episode, we are interviewing the artist Phyllida Barlow and curators who have worked with her. Phyllida has become one of the best known sculptors in the UK, working at the moment with some really major shows in Britain and around the world. But that's happened quite recently. So yeah. why are we interviewing Phyllida?
Well, what's really interesting about Phyllida is that until about 10 years ago, people used to call her the best sculptor that no one's ever heard of. And she was primarily known for her brilliant teaching career. And then suddenly, over the last 10 years, she's had this huge visibility. She represented Britain at the Venice Biennale. She's had a show at an installation at Tate Britain. She has been taken on by a major international mega gallery. And so we're really interested in why that happened, aren't we?
Yeah, and fairly late on in her career. And it's something that she talks about herself.
Exactly. So we went to her studio and she just moved studios. And I think it's testament to her, the busyness of her career, how loud the studio was. So excuse us for the kind of, there's a lot of background noise, isn't
there? Yeah, we had to kind of nestle in a corner away from kind of welding and chains. So yeah. The great thing is you hear the sounds of the studio.
The working studio.
Yeah, what's going on. But it creates, let's call it ambient noise.
Yeah. And we started off asking her about how she started off art school. So she studied at Chelsea in the early 1960s and then moved to the Slade. And Sarah, British sculpture at that time was quite, well, it was dominated by some really significant white male sculptors, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they controlled the scene. They probably got all the shows and the reviews and were the people who were teaching. And so people like Reg Butler and Phyllida talks about her interactions and how she had to kind of push back against some of the assumptions that they made about her training to be a sculptor.
That's right. So we start off in her studio early one morning.
So we're delighted to be here in your studio, which is so exciting. And obviously there's going to be there's people making. So
yes.
If there's noises, that's what it's going to be, isn't
yes,
it?
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Okay. And what we've found is that actually quite a lot of the artists that we're looking into did not start off studying sculpture. Mm. So they came to it in a different manner. You didn't start off studying sculpture, did you?
I was in painting, but and obviously from a young age I was doing lots of painting and drawing. But when I went to Chelsea Art School, one of the tutors said, I think you use paint like clay, and I think you should come to the sculpture classes, you know.
So that was a... Who was that?
That was Robert Clapworthy. And in fact, the name British Sculpture, I think, sort of can fill people with horror, and it's quite interesting to know why that is. And at that time, I think right at the very beginning of me going to art school in 1960, I was very infatuated by the sort of post-war generations of European art and British art. I understood it or empathised with it enormously, all its formal qualities and its slightly dark sort of renderings of humanity I found very compelling. And I think it took about two or a couple of years for me to suddenly turn quite aggressively against it all and wanted something very different. And it was another tutor called George Fullard, who's not particularly well known either, who was a great inspiration to look further afield, to look outside that quite particular formal language that became associated with Moore and Kent Armitage across to Lynn Chadwick and Ralph Brown, Bernard Meadows. I mean, they were quite a tribe.
Mm.
And somewhere in there is Elizabeth Frink, but I think in quite a distinctive form. And so I think Hepworth is as well. So,
and did you meet some kind of, with some resistance or raised eyebrows that you as a young woman student wanted to kind of intervene in this kind of sculptural world?
Well, I think it's sort of slightly peculiar, because I think when I think of Chelsea sculpture department at that time, which was just in two small rooms, not bigger than that, and on sculpture courses in general, there were, you know, you only ever had 6, 8, 10 students, whereas painting would have 20 or 30. So there was always this sense that you were in a smaller kind of cultural world anyway. One of the tutors at the Slade said, you can't do decoration on sculpture. It no longer is sculpture if you do that. And I said, but I've been looking at these Indian carvings, and I can't remember the rest of the conversation, but it was something like, yes, but that's what they do in India, but
you're at the Slade.
Yes, at the Slade.
My dear.
Yeah. Control yourself.
I mean, those sorts of situations where you're defending something, it's probably very good for anyone to be in that.
Gives you a bit of fight.
Yes. So it's quite interesting to have those challenges thrown down. But it's also, you know, you've got to muster this tremendous single-mindedness.
It's so fascinating to hear a famous, internationally famous, significant artist talk about the fact that her gender really did impact the way that her tutors at art school saw her, treated her, and how they envisaged her career going on, isn't it?
Yeah, but what's really interesting is she is not bitter about that, and perhaps that's with hindsight, now she is successful, but she uses that productively, that feeling of like, sod you, I'm going to get on with my
career.
I'm
going to show you.
Yeah, whatever you think.
Yeah.
And so she kind of pushes against it and goes her own way.
It's actually really brilliant to think that she is much more well-known than Reg Butler now, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Read you.
Yeah, exactly. But it's something that she's also talked about in a different context. So there's a project called Artist Lives, isn't there, Sarah, where she's interviewed for?
Yeah, it's an oral history project run by the British Library. And Artist Lives do very in-depth recordings with artists. They take them back to as far as they can possibly remember in their childhood and question, you know, the motivations behind becoming an artist, what shaped their career. So the Artist Life project have very kindly let us use their recordings of Phyllida talking about her art school years. She begins this next interview by talking specifically about her encounters with the sculptor Reg Butler at the Slade.
I did end up going to the Slade, and of course he was still there. And on the first day when I met him, he said, right, three things. One is, you don't come with any credit. And I thought, I didn't understand what that meant at all. But what he was saying, because he'd known my mother, that didn't mean it. Two is, and this is absolutely true, he said, because you're a woman, I'm not that interested, because by the time you're 30, you'll be having babies and making jam. And three, apart from Barbara, i.e. Barbara Hepworth, name any other British female, or whatever word, name a woman sculptor. And then quickly followed by, let me tell you, there are none. And those were the three things he said, and that was it. And I think those things can act as the most extraordinary triggers for your future. Because I remember when I did eventually go into teaching, I thought, the people I'm most interested in teaching, are the ones who are struggling to get a foothold on this whole system. Because if you've made that kind of decision to go to art school, and maybe you come from a background that isn't 100% supportive, all sorts of things, the last thing you need is a load of kind of self-opinionated so-called tutors as artists telling you this, that and the other. And I quickly wanted my teaching to just be of a totally different kind, you know. And actually, when I remember meeting George Fullard after, you know, my first year at the Slade, and he said, "What's it been like?" And I said, "Absolutely, excuse me," I said, "fucking awful." And I said, it's such a dark place," I said. And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, there's no light in the sculpture." And he said, Do you mean intellectually, artistically, or literally?" And I stopped and I remember thinking, I said, "All three." And then I told him the story about Reg Butler, and I remember George saying, "What he doesn't realise is that women will actually be the major artistic, you know, drive in a few years." He says, you know, he doesn't understand the notion of a female creativity and the number of men who also have to use the female side of themselves to make art. And I think he was a genuinely inspirational character, you know. But there was something about that whole stance of Reg Butler that was, I found, deeply, deeply disturbing and sort of brutal. At the end of my time at the Slade, Kenneth Armitage was the person who came and looked at the work of the students, because it was the Slade diploma then. It wasn't a BA degree or any of that stuff. And he didn't believe the work. I mean, this again just shows the sort of time. This was 1966. He didn't believe that the sculpture I had made was made by a woman. So the joke was that William Coldstream had to point me out. I find it incredibly sort of voyeuristic. The students were asked to stick around whilst this event was going on. I didn't know they were doing this. This was reported to me afterwards. And to show the photograph of me that they had on the records to show that this was done by a female student. I mean, what's all that about? You know, why would it be of any interest one way or the other? So I think those kind of experiences weren't exactly about becoming a rabid feminist. They were more that things that my hatred of things that make judgments before anything's happened, and a sort of a bit like my father giving me an absolute hatred of authority.
So after art school, she leaves Slade in the mid-60s, and she's included in some exhibitions. So there's an exhibition in 1965 called the Young Contemporaries Group Exhibition, which she's got a sculpture in. And then that's really also when she starts teaching. So in the late 60s, she takes up a teaching position in sculpture at Chelsea College of Art. She's very much in sculpture. She's making sculpture, she's teaching sculpture. But one of the things that we've thought about within this podcast is definitions of sculpture, isn't it, Sarah?
Yeah, and Phyllida, from the very beginning, is testing what
that means.
Yeah, what is sculpture? What are sculptural materials? And she's noted for using some kind of quite low-grade, low-tech materials as well, using fabric, pulling things out of the kind of everyday and pulling them into her practice.
Well, those kind of non-traditional materials. I suppose when people think about sculpture, you know, they're thinking about the bronze, the marble, that sort of thing. And with Phyllida, it's not at all, is it? It's much more ephemeral.
Yeah, and she's disrupting those hierarchies from the very beginning.
But we asked her about those kind of fluid definitions of sculpture, and also a bit more about her practice.
Yeah, and whether she sees herself as a sculptor.
So did you have a sense, or was there a moment when you gained a sense that you were a sculptor and this is what you're going to do as your career? Was there a moment where like a light bulb went on?
Absolutely. So the minute I went into the sculpture department at Chelsea, I wanted to make sculpture and be a sculptor. And this release from working with an image was just an image as a two-dimensional image. It was like a complete liberation of this sense of being with the whole form in front of me, especially clay and plaster. It was just like a sort of freedom, a freedom away from something, into something quite unknown.
Yeah. So you talk about the unknown and the freedom. How did that manifest itself in the materials that you were using?
They were quite straightforward, you know, clay mainly, and then casting. Mm-hmm. So clay to plaster. That's what I became fascinated mm-hmm. in, was the casting process, the sort of magic of an object disappearing and then reappearing in this other form. And it just seemed to me incredible that we were making things that would then could be quite weighty, could be heavy, but they would disappear. I think my fascination with sculpture as a language that stands in competition with the rest of the world around is ongoing as a kind of restraint. I mean, maybe that's not a good thing, or maybe it's a good thing, I don't know, and maybe I'm still finding out. So I don't think I particularly seek freedom, if you know what I mean, in inverted commas, but more this there's a drive there to be of the world and of now, but also in contrast or in maybe even in competition to that. Not that I want to compete with nature, because I don't think nature will always win.
Do you feel that there is still a definition of what sculpture is?
Well, I certainly know that it's not just about the object. It's about sensations of being in relationship to, whether that's weather or temperature or smell.
And are you thinking about how others experience your work as you make it, as you...
Not as I make it, but the minute it becomes, if it does, go for an exhibition or whatever, then I
do leave your studio.
Yes, yeah, but whilst it's in this stage, it's very much a relationship between me and this, and I'm not really about the viewer or the audience. So there's a dramatic shift when the work goes into a space.
Exhibitions are a major factor in shaping an artist's career and really catapulting someone into public visibility.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, getting them reviews and getting them talked about. And in the last 10 years, we can really see Phila de Barlow's exhibition history kind of intensifying.
Well, it's really interesting to see. So I think the first one that really propels her reputation forward is the 2012 show that she did at the Henry Moore Institute in Leeds. 2 years later, 2014, she's doing an installation at Tate Britain. Yes. And it's really 2017 where she's chosen by Britain to represent the country at the Venice Biennale, which really puts her on this international stage,
yeah,
doesn't it?
And she kind of took over the pavilion. It's a historic building designed at the end of the 19th century by Lutyens, and it's a very kind of neoclassical pavilion. And she puts her sculpture in there, and she said she wanted to occupy the guts of the building, and then all her forms, all her sculptural work kind of spilled
out. Really spilling out.
So she really uses exhibitions to kind of play with space, to disrupt institutional space, and kind of does a kind of takeover of them as
That's
well.
Right. And so within Folly, there's the kind of, she uses a lot of columns, but kind of stripping back the grandeur. You know, when we think about column, we think of all those classical proportions. Mm. That's taken away. She's using cheap industrial materials. She's not intimidated by the space at all, is she?
Not at
all. Kind of an overwhelming encounter when you go in.
Yeah, and then most recently she had a show at the Royal Academy. She is an RA, and she used the new spaces, the new galleries at the top of the building, which only opened in 2018. And we went there, didn't we, Jo, together?
We did, yeah. So obviously when the podcast, it's quite hard for us to give you an idea of that exhibition space, but we've tried to. So we're kind of, you'll hear us whispering, walking around the Royal Academy.
People giving us funny looks as we're sort of huddled under a sculpture having a
but
chat.
But just trying to give a sense of what that exhibition was. We're in the Royal Academy in the final week of Phyllida's exhibition Cul-de-sac, which is made up of three separate rooms of her work. And the title Cul-de-sac comes from the fact that it literally is a dead end. So you walk through the three rooms, and instead of coming out a different door as you usually would in an exhibition, the viewer is forced to turn back on yourself. And as you turn back and look at the three rooms from a completely different angle, it's a whole new sensation, isn't it? It's a completely different experience looking at the work.
You see the works in relationship to one another, don't you, in a new way. When you come in, you can only see parts of the work, and then it's this process of standing back and just having a new kind of encounter with the works as you look at them in this kind of series.
Exactly, and I think with Phyllida, the space and the exhibition area is crucial to the work, and she talks about the space being a protagonist, doesn't she? So they're working in tandem with the space, and you really see this with the galleries. And there's two different doorways, and the works are deliberately placed, I think, so that we can see right through to the final room and vice versa. So when you're at the end of the so-called cul-de-sac, when you look back, you can see all the other installations, and it's a completely different viewpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about these works occupying this space in the Royal Academy as well, and in relationship to the Academy's history. As a place of making, and actually these galleries have suddenly become like big studios with their top lighting, and they're sort of not kind of that hallowed hall, grand space, but they've become more, I don't know, workaday. And I think that might be something to do with the materials that Barlow uses, more kind of everyday. We've got plaster, we've got fabric, concrete,
cement. Because I think that normally in the Royal Academy you would see the experience of the kind of the finished bronze placed, presented on a plinth.
That's
whereas
right.
Here, the kind of the making, the process is actually part of the finished work.
It's like
revealed. So there's no artifice. So, you know, I'm looking up now, we can see pencil notes, you know, with numbers and measurements, paint everywhere. Mm-hmm. These are reused. So we're deliberately shown the kind of how things are formed together. So there's dried plaster, so we can see all that. That's not hidden. We can see the brush strokes, and that's a crucial part of it.
Absolutely.
The process is key, I think, in the work.
Should we just take a little walk around? Because we're kind of
We're dwarfed by them, aren't we?
Yeah, we're walking under and through them, and it's almost, you know, your body has a different relationship as you squeeze in between two giant
to duck down now under something. And normally that's a completely different gallery experience, because normally there you're not allowed to get up close.
No.
There's kind of the things are roped off and you look at them from one particular viewpoint.
Absolutely.
And obviously with sculpture you walk around it, but here we're encouraged to look over and under.
Yeah. And you're right about not having a plinth. I think that puts things into a completely different relationship. And actually in this second room of the exhibition there are things on the wall as well. So sculpture kind of coming out of the wall and floating as well.
Which is a really kind of visceral sensory experience, isn't it, as you're walking around and you're encouraged to. You can't walk through the doors, you know, kind of in one long way. You have to walk around the sculpture to get to the next room. You're forced to walk around it and view it in a different way. So we left that exhibition, and whilst we were still at the Royal Academy, we tracked down the curator there who was responsible for working with Phyllida and putting on that show, didn't we, Sarah?
Yeah, that's Edith Devaney, and she is the contemporary curator at the Royal Academy. And she talked us through the process from the conceptualisation of the exhibition to its realisation.
She was fascinated by the space, the fact that you've got very high ceilings, the fact that she felt that the wall as you come in the door was very close to you. So that was my first kind of experience of Phyllida saying, actually, it's really narrow. And I'm thinking, I know, we've got this lovely space and an artist thinks it's really narrow. But it was fascinating to work with her on the kind of gestation period. And she works in a very particular way, which I'm sure she's described to you. It's extraordinary, actually, because she puts such pressure on herself. She leaves everything to She's thinking about it for a long time, but the actual fabrication of the pieces happens quite late in the process. The pressure she puts on herself is part of the performance of the piece. I think that becomes a really important element. And she's probably spoken to you about, you know, the three elements that come together for her are the space. And she talks about them as being protagonists. It's the space, the work, and then the public coming in. So that the people, the visitors, are the third. And in the end, sort of the most important element in kind of understanding and bringing this work to life. So she was inspired by the space, had ideas about the work, and we had so many interesting conversations about it because I was obviously familiar with her work. I had seen her work at the Venice Biennale, which I thought was an extraordinary installation, but very dense. You know, she was really kind of almost competing with the architecture there and filling it, and there was kind of blazes of colour. And then I saw her commercial exhibition at Hausenworth in New York in the November before our show, and I really wanted this to be very different, and I wanted her to have that sense of freedom. She came up with the title really early on, Cul-de-sac, and she likes working in that way because it's obviously that's where her mind's going. And not only was she thinking about the idea of having to walk back on yourself and retrace your steps and how that would make you engage with the work, but she was also thinking of those kind of rather David Lynchian notions of suburbia with the sort of cul-de-sacs and the manicured lawns and something terrible going on behind that beautiful front door. You know, so that sort of thing was coming into play as well, which is more cinemagraphic. But I was really interested in engaging with how she sees herself as a sculptor and how she understands people will relate to it. And she said something that I thought, I don't think I'd ever hear a male sculptor saying that. And she said to me, and this was kind of early conversation, she said, I appreciate that people can walk past a piece of sculpture and maybe not take it in and not really see it. And she said, that doesn't matter that they're engagements of a particular type and it's very fleeting. She said, I still have a sense that they have a notion of it. And that's a kind of important thing. It's how it kind of makes you feel. And I think that goes back to the sort of whole idea of her thinking about working against the modernism that had come into play in the 1950s and 1960s. And she felt that there was this unspoken but underlying moralistic messaging in all of those kind of very masculine ways of sculpting. And whether that was one of the reasons that she turned towards the materials that she did. But of course, the thing about her materials is they're so anti-monumental that they don't last, and she knows that they're not permanent. And again, you know, that's such an unusual thing because, you know, everyone now is thinking legacy, it's the top line, isn't it? And she's just not thinking in that way at all. And I find that really interesting. And again, it goes back to that notion that she said, well, what's interesting is not the memory of the work in people's heads, it's the memory of how they felt when they encountered it. And it's a subtle difference, but it's a really important one. And it kind of has that absolute generosity of thinking and of spirit. And when you go back to that notion of how she sees the public and the visitor as one of the three protagonists, you can see exactly what she means. You know, it's their circumnavigation of the work, their emotional landscape that they're bringing with them and is influencing their engagement with the work that actually is a fundamental part of their appreciating that piece of art. I always kind of struggle about this notion of her being female and pushing that too much and being a mother, and you know, because that's spoken about, you know, her teaching career, the fact that she's got five children.
You get it, and really
I think we have to be really careful. Because I think she's much more important than her biography. Of course, it feeds into it, and this kind of, you know, she was working against that very male modernism that I described a moment ago. But she was looking elsewhere. She was looking towards Art of Bavera. She was looking towards what was going on in America, and that wasn't just by female artists. You know, she was looking at different expressions. and it was different ways of thinking and different materials, and you know, that element of softness and colour that comes into her work so often. Going back to that thing about how you encounter the pieces, and you know, the fact that your eyes pulled up, your eyes pulled across, you're circumnavigating them, you're looking at them at different angles. You know, Phillida says herself, you know, sculpture is quite hard work. I kind of know what she means, you know, because a painting has got one point of perspective, and therefore it's got a vantage point. So we all know that where we have to stand if we're looking at a painting or a photograph on the wall, but sculpture is very, very different. And how we engage with it, and what level, you know, whether you're on your hands and knees going, you know, because you see it differently, or you're looking up at it, or you're walking around it, you're looking, you're high up and you're looking down in it. All of those things make us feel very differently to it, and changes our sense of relationship to it. But just to kind of go back a little bit as to when I first met her, when Alison Wilding, I was doing something with Alison Wilding, got to know her and her work, and I admire her work tremendously. And she started talking about Phillida as the greatest sculptor, British sculptor, that no one's ever really heard of. And of course, that's before Hauser and Wirth. It's when she was still at the Slade. So I thought, I do have heard of her, but you didn't see her work much. I mean, it really wasn't. She didn't have a commercial gallery. You just didn't see it. So I checked it out, and with Alison's help, managed to get her to commission her to do something in the courtyard. So she did something before she was a member. So she did something as part of the summer exhibition. And she turned up in a transit van with all of these bits of painted stick in the sticks in the back, and then kind of set to work and created this extraordinary piece in the front. It was absolutely brilliant. And then, you know, all of it happened for her. But I, you know, maybe those years of just being able to do what she wanted have been very important for her.
We went back to Phillida's studio and asked her to reflect a bit more on kind of the successes she's had recently. And it's quite a personal conversation, I think, isn't it, to have with someone saying, you know, what's happened? What are the factors involved? Is it about money? Is it about gallery representation? The great thing about Phillida is she's really candid and so articulate. So she just kind of, she was very open with us in her responses.
Exactly. But also we're kind of assuming that different definitions of success, you know, just because she's more visible and she's having bigger exhibitions, she's been taken on by Hauser and Wirth, doesn't negate the rest of her career, does it?
Not at all.
So kind of when you're asking those questions, you have to be slightly aware of that. But as you say, she's very open, she's very candid about the impact that it has had on her work, and also enabling her to realise those more ambitious projects, I think, too.
Yeah, so having a major gallery representation from Hauser and Wirth, she's talked about how that has enabled some of those projects to happen in a way that if you were sort of self-funding, you were trying to make them happen yourself.
It's just not possible, is it?
And sculpture, as we've said before, is so expensive. And the practicalities of, you know, just shipping works and organising things, it does come with its own, like, logistical nightmares.
And even if you're using really inexpensive materials, it's still the fabrication. You still have to ship them. You've got to have a huge studio.
Studio assistants.
Yeah. You know, it's a kind of a small.
Well, it's a business.
Business, isn't it?
It is, and that is really significant in developing a career.
Yeah. So Phillida was great. She didn't mind us getting pretty up close and personal with her, did she?
She'd just tell us to bust out if she didn't want to answer a question.
Exactly. Well, here she is in her studio.
It just seems sort of fantastic that I can fulfil certain ambitions that although I was aiming for them before all this happened, they were going about in a very different way and they could never quite achieve what I have been able to sort of not achieve so much but as engage on in the last, say, 10 years, and I think that has given me a kind of new way of being in the world I want to be in, for making the world. So people always say to me, you know, have you changed since you've had a gallery? And I say, yes, of course I've changed, but it's not to do with being in the gallery. The gallery hasn't really changed. It's what the gallery has been able to support that has enabled me. I don't want to be making the same work that I made 10 years ago. You know, I'm glad it's evolved, but whether all the ways in which it has evolved are what I want it continuing, both as a constant discussion I have with myself.
And it's also interesting that we are so much of our artists now. For example, we've pulled you from your studio to be interviewed for this podcast. You know, I'm sure you know you're writing essays on Rhode Island. You're here, you're being interviewed for various films. Do you resent that?
No, I think it's very important to, as much as one is able to engage with as broad an audience as possible and not be afraid of that and not have, I don't know what the best audience is, you know. And I think, you know, a lot of people are very critical of the use, my use of size in the work. I'm very aware of what people find problematic with work, that it's ugly, or all these things that come up, and that how I stand in relationship to that is very important, and how that gets communicated verbally is another layer where maybe one can offer something that's sort of understandable to an audience, a potential audience. I certainly don't want to be a remote person.
And it does seem that sculpture has a particular function in a way, that it can find an audience by its presence in the world.
Yes,
and,
yes.
Well, Joe and I went to the Yorkshire Sculpture Park and we were looking at some of your work that's cited there in the park, and you're seeing people interact with those works who are probably not, you know, they're not art world, they're not an art world audience, they're going for a nice walk, they're going because they want some kind of solace or peace, and, you know, and then just seeing how people are actually having very genuine and quite, you know, sort of profound interactions with
quite
sculpture.
Incredible.
And, that's kind of quite moving, I think.
I think it's extraordinary. Venice, I sort of had a kind of huge, I don't know what, confrontation with what I'd done, you know. It made me realise that there's passive and active looking in the British Pavilion. You have to go to it, you have to walk around. There has to be that interaction in that way, which is an active, interactive, not a passive one.
And it's a sort of an unfolding experience. Yes. And I guess the same of your recent show at the Royal Academy, that sort of seemed to unfold as you walk through the galleries and then had to walk back, actually. That's quite an interesting experience.
I mean, I don't use particularly expensive materials, but it's still phenomenally expensive. If I want to pursue my interest in these qualities of height and space, then I need this sort of space to do that into. But I could easily say, right, stop it now, because these things are environmentally not good. So there's, everything is to me on a sort of knife edge of testing one's own integrity in a way. If I'm going to start worrying about the environment in the way that I think I must, then this has to go. I think that's where we're all at.
Yeah, it's a dilemma for the whole art world, isn't it?
Yes.
Exhibition making, touring, travelling, we're all in this
kind of bind,
aren't we? Wanting to be international.
Yes.
You know, how do we follow those ambitions and those, you know, which are, to my mind, noble ones to connect with the rest of the world, and yet also do as little damage as we can.
So you talk about the use of relatively inexpensive materials. Mm. Did that engagement with those materials start off as a practical concern, a practical reason?
Yes, I think practical, but also I loved those materials, clay. I think everything with me goes back to clay, even though I actually don't use it very much now. But I found the armature clay and the armature really quite a fascinating conversation and combination of sort of skeleton and flesh, if you like, and then gradually evolving those and trying to make work early on that didn't have an armature so that they were like completely solid stuff, and the stuff would always be things that I could get my hands on very cheaply, not necessarily from skips, which is what everybody says. I've never got anything with a skip.
Is that an urban myth? That's a Phila de Barlo urban myth, is it? The skip.
Well, not a skip, sir.
We've just moved studio, actually, which is why it's all a bit bare at the moment.
Was that for space reasons?
The lease came to the end, and it was eye-wateringly expensive. I mean, really horrendous, which is, I think, what London has become.
Have you always had your own studio?
For years I had it near where, right next door to where I live. My husband has a studio at the bottom of the garden, and I have one down the side of the house. Yeah.
And how did that work when your children were little?
I just carried on as best I could. and when the fourth and fifth came along, who were twins, it was then quite difficult, so I'd go into the studio very late at night. And that's when I became obsessed by darkness as a sort of ingredient of experience, because I would turn off all the lights in the studio, make works in the dark, and it's always become a source of fascination for me, the idea of sculpture in the dark. That sensing of something, but not being able to see it necessarily.
But that's interesting, isn't it? So the practical experience of having children, so then therefore you have to go to your studio late at night, then fed into something, into the work for you.
It did, very much, yeah. Not an easy time, and a time of being very out of circulation, you know.
It was a huge pleasure to spend so much time with Phila de Barlo talking about the arc of her career. And what was really clear to us from talking to others is what an inspirational figure she is. So many artists, curators and others look up to her and are really inspired by the work that she's doing.
That's right. So I suppose within her teaching career, she had such an influence on successive generations of artists. She is a lodestar, isn't she? Not just as a woman artist, as a sculptor, but really as an artist of international significance.
Definitely. And in her teaching career, she became professor of sculpture at the Slade. So became, you know, a kind of spokesperson for sculpture and cultural training in the UK. I think also what people really admire about her is, as an artist in her 70s, she is continuously experimenting with form, questioning the boundaries, and asking what is the role of sculpture in the world today. Thank you to everyone who has made this episode happen, particularly the sculptor Phila de Barlo, Edith Devaney, and all the other people who have supported us, especially the Paul Mellon Centre for Studies in British Art.
The images and exhibitions that we talk about in this podcast are all available to view on our Instagram page, which is @sculptinglives. Thank you and goodbye.
See you next time. Bye. This podcast was written and presented by Sarah Victoria Turner and Joe Baring, produced by Claire Lynch, with research assistance from Isabel Mooney.